Hello.
Welcome back to Old Millennials, a deep dive on shallow topics from the late 90s and early 2000s. I am one of your hosts, Margot Poupard.
And I'm your other host, Emily Bejean.
This world simply does not have enough joy. So I will no longer pretend that I am above pop punk, because I am not. I am a loud and proud Blink-182 fan. Yes, I have listened to Sum 41 sober on a Wednesday morning for non-old millennial purposes. What if Fat Lip is just good? Ever think about that?
And it's great song.
Thank you. I was contemplating, like, do I start it by saying, I stole him into the party like my name is El Nino,
or
is that incredibly white and dorky of me, or should I start the episode this way?
No, I plan on doing a little bit of rap rock verse rapping later in my segment on Sum 41, so you're fine.
Well, a ba with a ba to you, Emily.
Thank you. My name is Kid... No, I'll stop there.
No, and we're definitely not talking about Kid Rock at all today, or... I mean, I feel like that will be the extent of it. If you want to hear us talk about Kid Rock, I think it's like that 1999 singles episode we talk about him.
Yeah, but that's about it.
Back to our beloved pop punk, some from Southern California, some from Canada-ish. I will continue to defend Blink-182's self-titled or untitled, depending on who you ask. It is hands down one of their best albums, and I listen to it all the time. It was great to listen to Blink-182 all day while doing research, but also... like I told Emily before we hit record, that's also not really that far off from my regular day-to-day. It's actually kind of funny because early into pandemic time, one of the first kind of like funny conversations I had was about music taste regressing in quarantine, and that I immediately felt the teen angst and started playing a lot of Blink-182 and have not stopped.
The same here. I've listened to a lot of Blink, listened to a lot of Sum 41. I listened to Simple Plan at one point. and then I definitely dove into that emo playlist that we created for our emo episode, mm-hmm. which was a mm-hmm. plug that I did not intend to make during this episode, but I've just made.
I have gone back and listened to that playlist. It's pretty good.
It slaps.
It's not our fault that we picked great songs for this playlist. I would say we should do, actually, maybe we should do like a pop punk. I mean, not just Blink-182 and Sum 41, but we should. And to just bring it back around to our, what we love to do at the beginning of every episode, which is some personal anecdote with some banter. Have you seen either of these bands play live? And if you have, did you see them like on a Warped Tour, or did you see them at some punk venue that I'm unaware of in DC?
So I've seen Blink-182 at a festival in DC. It was at Columbia, Maryland. It was called the Virgin Mobile Free Fest, and it was free tickets, just as it sounds. And the headliners were Weezer, Blink-182, and Public Enemy. And I gotta say, Blink put on a great show. I mean, they played all, for lack of a better term, to borrow from Sum 41's album title, they played all killer, no filler. And they even went into an Every Rose Has Its Thorn by Poison cover towards the end, which was fantastic. So I enjoyed myself. How about you?
I got to see Blink-182 at the Universal Amphitheater, which is the, and I'm sure it's called something else now, but it's on Universal City Walk. It's the big amphitheater that they have. On their Take Off Your Pants and Jacket tour in 2001, it was a graduation gift from my dad, and Modest Mouse opened for them, which I thought was interesting. Because I would later see Modest Mouse on a first date with my husband at that same venue. And they had Man open for them. And that was the first time I'd ever seen Man Man. I was like, wow, this cult is actually like pretty good. Because they were all sort of dressed like, what's that?
Oh, the
band
Polyphonic Spree.
Thank you. I'm like, they're from Flower Mound, Texas. Like, that's all I ever remember of them. But yeah, I saw Man Man open for Modest Mouse. It's just an interesting little like circle of life there. But I love them. I got like a really cool shirt from that tour too, which was like, and it was an orange shirt, so I would wear it like around Halloween that had like a flower that was wilting, the petals were falling off, and it spelled Blink-182. And even my dad had a great time. They only, you know, they played some off of some off of Dude Ranch, and then it was mostly just like all Enema of the State and like a couple of the singles that were off of Take Off Your Pants and Jacket. But I had a great time. It was odd because it was a seated show and it felt like it needed to have a mosh pit. But I just remember thinking like, oh, I'm standing up. Like, I hope I'm not blocking someone's view. And it was also like one of the first like rock shows I had gone to as well. Because before that, I think the extent was I saw Brandy live in concert, like at the Hollywood Bowl, and Santana. And that was pretty much the extent of my concert life, you know, up until 13.
That's amazing. I, fun fact, didn't get to really see any concerts that were like non-classical or jazz until I was about 17 or 18, apart from like a high school band playing. Like when I think about like a, you know, major artist type of concert, I didn't really see any until I was like 17 or 18. I think my first one, I hate to say this, was a country music show.
Who'd you see?
Oh God. I think it was Trace Adkins and Gretchen Wilson. Ooh. Yeah. Not just like not fun country. I mean, like, I guess Gretchen Wilson had like one or two fun songs, but like both people who I'm pretty sure Trace Adkins was on The Apprentice. Gretchen Wilson, I'm not sure if she said anything problematic, but just like not the people, not like Dixie Chicks fun country, you know?
Definitely not. I once was invited to and then flaked on tickets to see what's his name? Keith, I was going to call him Keith Sweat. Nicole Kidman's husband, Keith Urban.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I do not regret that decision. I was like, yeah, maybe I'll go. And I think I listened to one song. I was like, I'm just not going to call her back about going. But I think I was mostly allowed to see rock concerts because my dad was like peak, like midlife crisis divorce guy. Like, I'm cool. I'm hip. And he went to all sorts of shows. Like, he saw Nine Inch Nails before I did. He saw Beck in concert several times at like a bunch of really nice venues too, obviously.
I had this dilemma happened to me about 10 years ago when I get a text from my parents that they are currently in Brooklyn visiting their friends and seeing Iron and Wine in concerts. And I'm like, what is happening here?
Yeah, that's a lot to take in, you know?
Yes.
All right. Well, I guess I will start about Blink-182, or as I like to call their origin story, what do you call a formation of white guys from Poway? As a sketch from a Blink-182 themed show once informed me, there are not a lot of famous people from Poway, California. In fact, judging by a quick skim, the two names that jumped out to me are Bruce Bochy and Lorenzo Lamas.
Wow.
I know. There were also like a bunch of other like baseball players and like football players. I'm like, but I don't know you. I mean, I know Bruce Bochy just because of the Giants. And then obviously Lorenzo Lamas, like self-explanatory. But you know who else comes from the San Diego suburbs? Members of Blink-182. Formed in August of 1992, after Tom DeLonge was expelled from his high school for showing up to a basketball game wasted, he was forced to finish the semester at another school where he'd meet their original drummer, Scott Raynor. DeLonge also befriended Carrie Kay, who was dating Ann Hoppus, Mark Hoppus' sister. Ann introduced Hoppus to DeLonge, and with their shared interests in the Descendants, skating, and surfing, they hit it off immediately and began performing music in Tom's garage. They played for hours, exchanging lyrics and co-writing songs, which one of them would eventually become Carousel. The trio would practice together also in Scott Raynor's room, and at some point, in hopes to try to impress Tom, who was younger than Mark. Mark is the oldest person in this band to this day. Mark fell from a lamppost in front of Tom's house and cracked his ankles and ended up on crutches for 3 weeks, which had very big, like, that thing you do energy. Remember when Giovanni Ribisi is over the meters and then he breaks his fucking arm as a drummer?
Yes.
Anyway, before they settled on Blink, they went through a couple names like Duct Tape, but duck is spelled like quack quack duck, and Figure Eight. But then they just settled on Blink. As Blink started to take form, Mark was living with his girlfriend and barely scraping by. He was working part-time at a record store, I think. Mark went out and bought his first professional equipment, a new amp and a bass cabinet. He came home and his girlfriend proceeded to yell at him, angry that he had spent what little money they have on something she felt that they didn't need. Quote, "I just kept telling her, this is what matters to me. This is my life," Hoppus recalls. She demanded he make a choice between the band and her, which resulted in Hoppus leaving the band shortly after they had just formed and like settled on a name. Tom and Scott borrowed a four-track recorder from their friend, and they were preparing to record a demo tape with someone else on bass, which prompted Mark to dump his girlfriend and then come back to the band. Fly Swatter, which was a combination of original songs and punk covers, was recorded in Raynor's bedroom in May of 1993. Tom, in 2013, reflected on the band's foundation, saying thus, quote, "We had a lot of fucking fun. We were out all night skateboarding. We were out throwing food and drinks at security guards who were chasing us through malls, skateboarding at 4 a.m, eating donuts at places, making hot donuts near the beach, breaking into schools and finding skate spots in dark schools, or skating down parking lot garages naked and shit in downtown San Diego," which, reading all of their quotes about how the band got together and how well they hit it off just makes me bummed about how things ended for them.
Yeah.
And sort of makes you a little bit nostalgic. Like, and it also proves that Beastie Boys kind of accomplished a difficult thing, which was staying friends throughout all of it.
100%. And also just shifting their music at the appropriate times, which I think Blink-182 yes. did pretty well. But honestly, I think they did it in such a way where they put so much focus on their side projects, which you'll get into later, I'm sure. But like, it got to a point where, you know, they couldn't come back.
It was a combo of things, but mostly it comes down to an unofficial fourth member of the band that I will talk about later. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the band started getting booked every weekend, from Elks Lodges to the YMCA to clubs. They also started to convince high schools to let them play under the auspices that Blink actually had, quote, motivational. They were a motivational band with a strong anti-drug message, in hopes of playing like an assembly or like, you know, how sometimes at lunch they would let a band play.
Yeah.
The band grew in popularity and they quickly got on the local circuit with other bands like 10 Foot Pole and Unwritten Law. And they were soon the opening act at SOMA, which was a local all ages venue. One of the band's biggest dreams when they first started was to headline there. Meanwhile, Mark's manager at the record store that he worked at, Patrick Secor, decided to front the money to the band so they could record a proper demo, which was the result was Buddha in 1994, which the band members viewed as their first legitimate release. Later that year, Scott's family relocated to Reno, where he was briefly replaced by musician Mike Kroll. But the band eventually just saved money and would fly Scott out to shows. And eventually in mid-95, he moved back and he moved in with Mark Hoppus. So in their early years after Buddha, they signed to Cargo Records on a, quote, trial basis, whatever the fuck that means. And because Mark was the oldest and the most unemployed one, because Scott Rayner was still a minor, and I think that Tom was like working somewhere else, he was the only one that technically signed to Cargo. But the band goes on to record Cheshire Cat, that was later released in February of 95, and they had recorded it in 3 days. Eminem is their first single, and it starts to get local airplay on 91X, which I'm sure if we had Eileen or John Cross on here, they could tell us just how fucking cool that radio station is, since they are our San Diego experts. But based off of the success of Eminem, two things happen. Cargo gives them money to shoot a music video, which I went back and watched, and it was about what you would expect. Like, looked a little self-produced, self-directed, like it's them playing in an undisclosed location, but looks like a giant empty warehouse, but it's all dark, so you can't really tell what's happening in the background. Two of the three members have bleached hair, which I was like, that is a cry for help when two men have bleached hair and they're in a band together.
You only get one member with bleached hair. That's it. Maybe a frosted tip, so 1.5. You get 1.5 members per band.
Emily, I barely recognized Tom DeLonge with that bleached hair. I was like, who the fuck is that guy? And then he like took off his sunglasses at one point. I'm like, whoa, blonde hair is not for you. It's not for everyone.
No.
It's not for Tom DeLonge.
Certainly not.
But, so they shoot this music video and Cargo gave them money. And then they get popular enough that a British band called Blink is like, change your name or we'll fucking sue you. So they agreed to change their name. And after some back and forth with Cargo, they eventually just threw a random 182 at the end. At the end of all of this, they signed with manager Rick DeVoe, who at the time also represented NoFX, Pennywise, and The Offspring, and Tahoe Booking, who signed them up for their first national tour in 1995. The tour was to promote a surf video called Good Times, directed by Taylor Steele, who was a very good friend of their manager, Rick DeVoe. And also, it makes sense that they're on tour to support a surf video, because the second time I heard a Blink song was in a skate video, which, you know, surf, skate, I know they're not necessarily the same thing, but it's the same type of person. The first time I heard a Blink song was in Can't Hardly Wait.
Oh, no, I was just going to say the same thing. Like, they play Damn It in the movie, and I think that might have been the first time I heard them.
That song fully just reminds me of Can't Hardly Wait. Every time yeah. I hear it, that's all I can think about
the
is that giant
party. Is getting busted.
Exactly. So the tour goes so well that they extended it and added a leg to Australia. But when they couldn't afford to fly out there, Pennywise paid for all of their tickets, which was very nice. And the guitarist of Pennywise, Fletcher Dragg, also insisted that Blink-182 get signed to play the 96 Warped Tour. And we're basically touring after that on and off the Warped Tour for over a year. And by March of 96, there was a three-way bidding war to sign them to a major label between Interscope, MCA, and Epitaph. MCA promised them complete artistic freedom, and they ultimately signed with them. But their drummer at the time, Scott, really wanted to go to Epitaph. And that was sort of the beginning of the end for him and the band. They also got a bunch of shit from the punk community for quote-unquote selling out, but what the fuck ever. In late 96, they recorded Dude Ranch over the course of a month with producer Mark Trombino, who has produced tons of punk bands, but in addition to that, has also produced every single Jimmy Eat World record. If you look at his credits, yeah. It's the one band he's done every single record for. Mm-hmm. It was released in 1997, right before Warped Tour, and the first single off Dude Ranch, Damn It, hit gold by the end of 98, thanks to heavy rotation on radio. But the grueling touring schedule and personal issues, Scott started to drink a lot, to the point where I assume it affected his performance, and even though he agreed to quit drinking and go to rehab, Mark and Tom fired him in mid-98. That's when our short, rhythmically gifted king, Travis Barker, enters the picture. Please know I've loved Travis since 1998. I've loved Travis Barker since the eighth grade. So
every tattoo tells a story. The man is just like a walking story. Just all sorts of stories.
And he's also 5'9". I had to look it up because I was like, before I like put him on blast by calling him short, I just want to make sure I'm checking my facts right. At the time, Travis was the drummer for their tour mates, the Aquabats. And Travis managed to learn their 20-song set list in 45 minutes. Mal was, what the fuck? That's crazy. And by July, he was their permanent drummer.
Quick story. I watched a ska punk documentary because I am me. And they interviewed the Aquabats and they talked about that show in particular. And they were like, the moment that show happened, we were like, fuck, we are losing Travis to this band. And that was it.
Yeah, I'm really bummed. I must have seen the Aquabats in that time when they were like switching over drummers, because I feel like I would have remembered seeing Travis Barker. But around this time at a bar and or bat mitzvah, I cannot remember which one, the kid had rich enough parents that they had the Aquabats play their party. And I remember that being like the first time I'd heard ska music outside of Clueless. And I was like, oh, cool. I think I like ska. But I don't remember Travis Barker being there is the main point. So that must have been around the time that he had left. After tour wrap, they returned to the studio with Jerry Finn, the producer responsible for their huge mainstream albums, Enema of the State, Take Off Your Shirt and Jacket, and self-titled Untitled. And Jerry is who I'm referring to as the unofficial fourth member. So we're going to now get into peak Blink-182 time, like that inescapable time between 1999 and 2002, where their music videos and their songs were constantly on the radio and constantly on MTV. And even if you did like them, you were starting to feel exhausted, right? So released it on June 1st of 1999, Enema of the State was recorded over 3 months between LA and San Diego. Their lyrics were inspired by adolescent frustration, relationships, and UFO conspiracies. The infamous cover art featured porn star Janine Lindmuddler in a nurse outfit. Still being accused of being sellouts, these sellouts sold over 50 million records, and all three singles, What's My Age Again, All the Small Things, and Adam's Song, were a bigger commercial success than the band and the label could have imagined. All the Small Things peaked on the Hot 100 at number 6, calling it like a crossover hit, which is huge for like a big band. But all three hit the top 3 on the rock and alt charts. They were also a fucking hit on MTV, and all three music videos dominated TRL. I'm sure all of you remember all three. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. All the Small Things was that spoof on all of the boy band music videos, which I thought was really hilarious because the music videos they were spoofing were also charting on TRL at the exact same time.
At the same time, yeah.
And I'm not sure if teens like fully grasp the irony of that, but that's very funny. What's My Age Again that was their big hit. And they were most known for up until All the Small Things as being the guys who are running around naked in their music video. And then Adam's Song is, you know, a sadder, slower song that they eventually retired after the tragic plane crash accident that I will briefly touch on towards the end. But that's a little bit more, they're like in a house, it's a little bit darker. It's sort of like their version of Stan, like Eminem Stan. Think of that. Yes. So all three of these music videos, though, dominated TRL. Enema of the State also had a considerable effect on pop punk music, inspiring a quote-unquote second wave of the genre and even a couple ripoffs. The success also of Enema of the State launched them on their first arena tour. So they graduated from kind of playing clubs and opening maybe for bigger acts in an arena for Warped Tour to being the headliner, in addition to cameos on TV and in American Pie. But they were rushed by MCA to produce their follow-up. So they released Take Off Your Pants and Jacket June 12th, 2001, 2 years post Enema of the State. Take Off Your Pants and Jacket became their first number one album in the US, Canada, and Germany. The singles, The Rock Show, which was written in 10 minutes, basically on a dare. Their manager said, you don't have any summer fun songs. And Tom DeLonge took that personally, just like Michael Jordan, and wrote The Rock Show.
I was about to say it.
Also, they have Stay Together for the Kids and First Date. All were on the top 10 on the rock charts. Jerry Finn, now the unofficial fourth member of Blink-182, returned as their producer slash mediator. So he was sort of like the go-between Tom and the rest of the band, because at around this point, Tom and the rest of the band were constantly at odds about what the sound and direction of Blink would be. And so Jerry Finn kind of kept them on the cohesive sound path because Tom really wanted to do his signature shit, which was like his nasally singing voice, which is fine, especially like for emo-y post-hardcore punk like kind of music, and just heavy fucking guitar, like constant guitar riffs. Finally, with a break between touring and recording, Tom decides to channel all of his underappreciated musical tastes and talents into a different band, Boxcar Racer. Boxcar Racer will mark the downfall of Blink-182 because Tom asks Travis to come play drums on a couple tracks, effectively leaving Mark out, and what's supposed to be just some side project for Tom turns into this quote-unquote duo from Blink-182, especially when Boxcar Racer goes on tour not once but twice. Even though Tom swears up and down he didn't mean to leave Mark out, the damage is done and the divide between the band begins here. I love dude bro fights too. Like, a part of me is like, come on, guys, just communicate. But also, that's exactly why they are the way that they are and they don't speak to each other now. In the meantime, our king, Travis Barker, is staying booked and busy and minding his own fucking business. He starts another band with Rancid's Tim Armstrong, which is he's questionable now in retrospect, but he starts the Transplants with them, which I actually really liked, you know, going back to the ska side of you and I's musical tastes. And after their little band break, the gang gets back together to record their fifth album and their best album. It's a departure from what we're used to with Blink-182, but I think, with the exception of the track with Robert Smith, which I loved at the time but cannot stand now, the experimentalism kind of works in their favor. Inspired by all becoming fathers for the first time around this era and all of their different side projects, they still have like a couple of other typically horny songs, especially Feeling This, but I feel like it all kind of works. Like, they took some risks that I thought really kind of pay off, and maybe it's an album that sounds better now than it did in 2003, but I think also out of all of like the songs and lyrics that they've composed, I would say it's the most timeless, because some of like the, like, I'm making like dick and fart jokes, like, are very funny and have a time and place, where I feel like there are some tracks on this album that you can kind of listen to anytime.
Yeah.
We're going to move past that to Self-Titled. Untitled was released November 18th, 2003 through Geffen, which had by that time absorbed MCA earlier that year, which I don't like to use that terminology when it comes to business, like absorb, like it feels kind of gross, but I don't really know how else to describe what happened to MCA. The album debuted at number 3, and both singles, Feeling This and I Miss You, both charted in the top 20 of rock charts, with I Miss You going to number 1. On the European leg of their 2004 tour, tensions rose to an untenable degree, and they scrapped plans to promote what would have been their third single, Always, another excellent song. And now that explains why that single never got more love off that record. So on February 22nd, 2005, Geffen released a press statement announcing the band's, quote, indefinite hiatus. Tom felt conflicted about his creative freedom within the group and the toll of touring was taking on his family life, so he asked the band if they could have 6 months off, which Mark and Travis thought was a really long break. After a contentious benefit show and some heated exchanges, Tom decided to exit the band and left the public eye. But Tom would return to the public eye in the fall of 2005 to announce his new band, Angels and Airwaves, and also let us know that he is for real into aliens and shit.
Oh, yeah.
Big time. I mean, I know that he blames being addicted to painkillers at the time for like the kind of kookiness, shall we say, of that press release announcing Angels and Airwaves, but he has since to go on to talk about aliens shit multiple times. So like, we can't all chalk it up to just painkillers, okay? Like, you really do just believe in it. And
when
I wonder
you do
if he's going to
show you're in.
I was going to say, do you think he's mad Demi Lovato got her, or sorry, got their own alien spinoff show?
It is funny you should say that, because I posted the same thing on Twitter a week ago.
Full circle, baby. It always comes up old millennials. We know this. So in the meantime, Mark and Travis also started a new band, Plus 44, which wasn't as successful as Angels and Airwaves. But again, Travis stays booked and busy and minding his own business. And he goes on to star in a reality show in 2005, which I believe Tom and or Mark and or both were not happy about. He also starts Famous Stars and Straps and generally is just a working drummer. He taught Rihanna, okay? The band didn't speak to each other until 2008, when two tragedies struck back to back. First, Jerry Finn dies suddenly of a cerebral hemorrhage, and Travis survives a fucking plane crash. Rallying around Travis brings them all back together, and once he's out of the hospital, they all agree to reunite officially. And at the 2009 Grammys, as presenters, they announce their reunion and go on a tour that following summer with Weezer and Fall Out Boy.
That's when I saw that, by the way.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Talk about a tour geared towards old millennials.
Yes.
But because of part of Travis's PTSD and it involves flying, they had to travel by bus and ocean liner, which I remember because everybody made a big deal about them. Like, oh, isn't that so cool? They're taking an ocean liner to Australia. But after tour, they try to record together, but that doesn't work. So they all record in their separate little like home studios, like those old married couples who don't live together but refuse to divorce. This plus the non-unifier of Jerry being around, the same old shit starts to happen, which is they don't fucking communicate. So they eventually put together their sixth and final album in this formation, Neighborhoods, and it was released September of 2011 and hit number 2 on the Billboard charts. Eventually, Tom will leave again, and Mark and Travis decided to sail without him, as they say, and hired Alkaline Trio's Matt Skiba in March of 2015. And that's where we're at today, because Blink-182 still releases music. They released a song, or I'm sorry, they released a single during quarantine called Quarantine. And I think as recent as 2018, they had another album. 2017, sorry. There's a deluxe edition. But yeah, and that's Blink-182.
So as you were talking, I did check the date of the concert I saw when I saw them live in 2009, and I was immediately jolted and remembered I saw them 2 dates after DJ AM had died, and they were a little emotional on stage. I had forgotten about this because it's been so long. I know that like I had seen videos from the night like the night they played before where they were very emotional, but yeah, they were a little emotional at when I saw them because it was literally 2 days after he had died.
Well, after he passed, that's when they decided to retire Adam's song. Yep. So. Which I have to say before we talk about Sum 41, I think it is kind of incredible that these, I mean, I guess they were older than their audience, obviously, but these sort of like early 20s men wrote really catchy songs about difficult subjects like teen suicide and your parents getting divorced and made them mainstream singles that people like really related to and really identified with. And I think they had a huge part sort of in teen culture from 99 to 2002.
100%. I think Sum 41 to an extent also did the same thing. I mean, their biggest hit songs were definitely the faster ones that were not like that, but they definitely had a few of those as well, for sure. And on that note, when I was 13 years old, I spent a lot of my summer with my French aunt who lives in Montreal and later went to summer camp north of the city in Saint-Gervais, Quebec. During that summer, my aunt invited me over to one of the teachers, or she invited to dinner one of the teachers from the Montessori school that she ran. And this teacher also happened to be a part-time nanny to a girl. And this girl came over for dinner with the teacher, proceeded to give my sister and I several CDs from various Canadian bands that were signed by Aquarius Records, that this label that her father, Terry Flood, co-founded. Of those CDs was All Killer, No Filler, the classic album recorded by the band that I'm talking about today, Sum 41. So Sum 41 is a band that was formed in Ajax, Ontario. Ajax, for those of you who don't know, is a suburb of Toronto about 25 kilometers or 16 miles away from the city. The band originally formed under the name Casper in 1996 when the original members were in 10th grade at Exeter High School. The original members were guitarist Derek Whibley, drummer Steve Yauch, John Marshall, and Richard Roy. When they first began, Marshall was the lead singer and Whibley was the lead guitarist, while Roy was the bassist and Yaux was the drummer. After going to the 96 Warped Tour, where Blink-182 performed, pivotal Warped Tour year, and being super inspired by the acts like NoFX and Pennywise and Blink-182, they decided to change their band's direction, and they also decided to change the name based on the fact that this was their 41st day of summer vacation and decided they would name the band Sum 41 as well, as a result. In 1998, the group would begin working with Greg Norrie as their manager and producer. Norrie, who was the co-lead singer and guitarist in the Canadian band Trouble Charger, would suggest Whibley become the lead singer, which resulted in John Marshall leaving the group. With Whibley now on vocals, Dave Bauch would step in as lead guitarist. And I am so sorry if I butcher that name. I tried finding a clip on YouTube where someone pronounced it, and I had no luck. He was a friend of the band members and had gone to the same high school as them. An additional lineup change would occur in 1998 when the band got into a near-fatal car accident. Bassist Richard Roy decided to leave the group, and after a brief stint with Mark Spicolek as their bass player, Jason McCaslin, or otherwise known as Cone, would join as the permanent bassist in 1999. And it's at this point that I should probably note that all four members from the group's heyday have nicknames, which they're fairly known by among fans and are credited with in their album's liner notes. So I got my explanations from a Tripod webpage that is still around called number4some41fansonly.tripod.com. Derek Whibley is Busy D because he gets busy, and that's spelled B-I-Z-Z-Y, by the way. Dave Boksh is known as Hot Chocolate and Brown Sound because of his Indian heritage and because it's a nickname for Eddie Van Halen's guitar sound.
Jason, oh my God, sorry. That's like, it's offensive on like every level. And also, it's a fucking busy.
I know.
Disgusting.
I do think the Brown Sound was self-picked by him. So at least it's a little less like he brought that on himself versus having others bring it upon him.
Jason, it's still upsetting to hear it.
It is still upsetting, and he still very much goes by it. Jason McCaslin is known as Cone, a nickname he got from Whibley in high school because, as teenage boys are so original, he ate ice cream cones daily. So as a lactose intolerant. As a lactose intolerant person, I cannot relate to this. But
just pounding those after school ice cream cones.
So there's a 40-something man who just goes by Cone now. And Steve Yacht is known as Steve-O-32. And this was pre-Jackass, by the way, because he's terrible at sports and thinks that athletes who wear the number 32 excel at sports, which, I mean, he's not wrong. There's Shaq
Magic,
Dr. J, Karl Malone, et cetera, et cetera.
I mean, it's really got to be 24, but whatever, guy. It's fine.
So with the lineup changes, the group recorded a demo cassette in 98 that initially received no attention from an American or Canadian companies, so nor either manager.
Wow.
Yeah. Then he decides he's going to send out a videotape of them shooting water guns around downtown Ajax, but set to the same music. And because I guess everyone is like off the heels of Blink-182 doing really well and like all these other pop punk bands kind of, you know, making big, selling big numbers of records, they get all sorts of record labels interested in them. And they ultimately end up signing with Island Def Jam in 1999. And then in Canada, they were distributed by Aquarius Records, which is what I talked about earlier. So their debut EP, Half Hour of Power, was named that way because the album clocks in at just a few minutes under half an hour. And that's the thing with all these pop punk albums, by the way. Not only are they fun to listen to, they're also fast. So you're not listening to it for longer than like 40 minutes tops. So this was released June 27th, 2000 via Big Rig Records, a subsidiary of Island, which, you know, remember subsidiaries.
The EP, they get absorbed by their sister company.
So hardcore. The EP was recorded in 2 weeks, basically featured their concert set list, but it produced the debut single Makes No Difference, which was featured on several soundtracks, including Bring It On and Van Wilder. And what's notable about this song is that the music video takes place at a house party where the band is playing and features DMX riding on an ATV around the house.
R.I.P.
R.I.P. So when he passed away, all these people were talking about tributes, and Sum 41 just talked about how sweet he was. So he ended up in this video because he happened to be filming Exit Wounds in Toronto with Steven Seagal. And according to Derek Whibley, someone at the record company, because DMX was on Def Jam as well, was like, wouldn't it be cool if DMX was in the video? And so he was filming in Toronto. He's like, yeah, I'll be on this. And he agreed and just did this cameo. And Derek Whibley was just like, yeah, there's no way he knew who we were. But since they were label mates, he was down to do it. And apparently Sum 41 was like Def Jam's only rock band at the time.
That I was going to ask, because I was like, because Island Def Jam also had like, I don't know, I want to say like DeBrat. I know that's not true, but like they had a lot of like rappers and like not even just like black artists, like they just didn't have more than like one person as a band, like that they were repping. It was a lot of like solo artists, period.
100%. So yeah, they were very much an anomaly at this label. When the band went back in the studio to record All Killer No Filler, according to Whibley, they only had a few songs to record and spent all their record label money on drinking, strip clubs, etc., because they were 19-year-old boys in Ontario where they were of the legal drinking age. They later went to LA and finished it, and it was actually produced by Jerry Finn, who we already talked about with Blink-182. The album's cover with the band members making faces was just taken from a bunch of Polaroids that they had taken of themselves and hung up on the walls of the studio as a joke. And we're just like, hey, this will make a good album cover. It was released May 8th, 2001 and sold. So the numbers are all over the place, but the one I could find was 3.5 million copies, but I'm pretty sure it sold more than that. It went triple platinum in Canada. In the UK, was among the top 30 best-selling albums of 2001 in Canada. And the album would peak at number 9 on the Billboard 200 and would produce three main singles, Fat Lip, In Too Deep, and Motivation. And then there's a fourth single called Handle This, which was only released in Germany and Japan, which happens a lot for Sum 41 for some reason. The first single, Fat Lip, classic, was released April 22nd, 2001, peaked number 1 on the Billboard Modern Rock chart and number 66 on the Billboard 200, and to this day remains one of their most successful singles of all time. He said, Derek Whibley said in a recent Stereogum interview about the song's 20th anniversary that it almost didn't even get on the album. It was a last minute add. And ultimately, the song did pretty well when it was first released, but it got super boosted because they topped the TRL charts, they topped the Much Music Countdown in the summer of 2001, and then they were asked to perform at MTV's 20th anniversary show, where they got to perform with Judas Priest's Rob Halford and Motley Crue's Tommy Lee. Judas Priest, as you might remember, is referenced in the song lyrics, "Heavy metal and mullets is how we were raised. Maiden and priest were the gods that we praised." And that's the extent of the Sum 41 rap rock that I'll do for today. But I wanted to get just one of those in. Into Deep.
I'm applauding you mentally.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Obviously, the other singles, In Too Deep, was huge, number 10 on the Modern Rock chart. And it was co-written by Whibley and Greg Norrie, originally intended to be a reggae song for Norrie's band Treble Charger, featuring a verse by the rapper Snow, as in Informer, Lick Your Boom Boom Now.
Whoa.
That is the most Canadian shit.
Is it just because... Yeah, is it just because they're Canadian that they teamed up?
I don't know, but I will say with Canada, there is this thing called CanCon where you have to a percentage of the music played on the radio has to be Canadian to an extent of like having been recorded in Canada or performed by a Canadian artist, or I don't know, but maybe it had to do with that. Who knows? Anyway. Motivation was released in January of 2002, and I should note that the music videos for Motivation, as well as Fat Lip and In Too Deep, were directed by Mark Classfield, and that guy just had like the craziest three-year period I've ever seen, because he directed, and this is just a sample of some of the videos, Nelly's Country Grammar, Batter Up and Ride With Me, Ludacris's Area Codes, NSYNC's Girlfriend, Bubba Sparks' Ugly, Vanessa Carlton's 1,000 Miles, Three Doors Down's Love Me When I'm Gone, and a couple of other Sum 41 music videos. So he was doing very well.
Jesus.
I know. Prolific. And I had to cut that down. So they end up spending most of 2001 opening for Blink-182 and The Offspring. They end up playing over 300 concerts in 2001 before returning to the studio to record their follow-up, Does This Look Infected? So they started recording for 6 to 8 weeks once they were done with their initial touring in 2002, and then continued to do the recording while on the road, which the release dates for these Sum 41 albums, they're like a boy band. Like they release an album in 2001 and then they release an album like 18 months later. It's pretty nuts. So Does This Look Infected would be released November 26, 2002. It would go on to peak at number 32 on the Billboard 200 and number 8 on the Canadian Albums Chart. The special edition came with a DVD called Cross the T's and Gouge Your Eyes, How Early 2000s Pop Punk of You, Sum 41. The album has since sold over 4.5 million copies worldwide, which sounds weird because I think All Killer No Filler sold more, but I digress. This album would have a few singles such as Still Waiting, The Hell Song, and then Over My Head, Better Off Dead. Which, by the way, when you just say these singles without any sort of context, just like is so pop punk early 2000s. Like, who else would name their songs these way? Like, anyway, I digress. The album cover features Steve Yox dressed as a zombie and was chosen months before the title. And the EP, which is Does This Look Infected 2, also features another zombie, but this time it's Whibley dressed up as a zombie. The following album has one of the craziest stories that comes before it. So after they're touring, in between touring for Does This Look Infected, they begin work on their album and they go and take a trip in 2004 to the Democratic Republic of Congo with War Child Canada to shoot a documentary on the effects of the Civil War. They arrived in the midst of a year and a half ceasefire, but during the trip, about 10 days in, while having breakfast at their hotel, the war began again and they were basically stuck in this hotel. And this UN peacekeeper by the name of Charles Chuck Pelletier instructs everyone to leave the restaurant, get in like in a hotel room, which most of them ended up in Cone's hotel room, our very lactose tolerant bass player.
Our superhero that can take on all of this lactose.
Essentially, though, Pelletier was able to secure armored carriers to take them and the rest of the hotel's occupants out of the hot zone. And they get the carriers to arrive 20 hours later, and they're taken to safety. And as a result of this experience, they decide to name their next album after him, and it's called Chuck. Really the wildest thing I came across.
Yeah, it's really like a very long scenic drive to get to the title of this album. I also vaguely remember like the Kurt Loder MTV news update about them getting stuck in the Congo, which like, why were they there for a documentary? Because it's Canadian?
I think they were just, I think War Child was like a big nonprofit at the time. And I think they got musicians to do that kind of thing. That's pretty much it, I think.
That's wild. I just feel like, why would you send these dudes?
No idea. Choices were made. Ultimately, Chuck is released on October 12th, 2004. They spawns four singles. We're All to Blame, Pieces, Some Say, No Reason. And the album will end up winning a Juno Award in 2005 for Best Rock Album of the Year. The next sequence in this bio is called Changes. So their manager, Greg Norrie, stops managing them in 2004. And then in May 2006, lead guitarist David Bach, I'm not going to bring up his nickname again, would announce in a statement that he was leaving Sum 41 to work with his new band, Brown Brigade, saying, quote, "I couldn't continue on creatively in Sum 41 without being a thorn in the side of the band. As people grow, they change." But ultimately, it was all amicable. The statement later read, "The first thing Steve Cohn and Derek told me was that they just want me to be happy. It was awesome to hear that we all had the same feelings. We are brothers, and no matter what, they are Sum 41, and they will make an incredible album. Peace, love, and all the above."
I'm going to start sending off my emails like that.
Please do. It's the new, hey, all you cool cats and kittens.
It's 2021's cool cats and kittens.
The band would eventually hire Gob frontman Tom Thacker as the replacement touring guitarist and would have him join as an official member in 2009. And I should note that there was a lot of speculation at the time that Dave left the group because of Avril Lavigne coming in as the new guitarist. And I should note that this is, yes, at this time is when Wibley married Avril Lavigne, effectively becoming, and our Canadian listeners will politely murder me after I say this, Canadian pop punk royalty. They would
eventually. How old were they when they got married? They must have been so young.
She's a little bit younger than him. He was like 25. She was like barely 20, I think, or 21. So they were fairly young. And needless to say, they did separate in 2009 and later divorced in 2010. The band, as a trio, would begin their work on their next album, Underclass Hero, in November of 2006. It ended up being produced by Derek Wibley, who was reluctant to step in that role, but ultimately they just couldn't find another producer, and it kind of happened that way for some reason. It was released in 2007 and sold a million copies, had four singles, including March of the Dogs, an iTunes promo single. Remember those? Also,
yes, that's how I got, remember Micah or whatever? Like,
Mika.
Like
Thank you.
Yeah. That, and also that's how I found out about Haim.
Oh, do you
remember I got an iTunes promo single for The Wire.
Remember that time we all got that awful U2 album Force downloaded on our iTunes?
Oh my God. Yeah, you mean the day that everybody collectively threw their iPhones into the ocean? Yes, I do.
Kids will never know, man.
Never know the struggle. Never know the struggles we've seen with technology.
Also, this single in which he goes after then-President George W. Bush and alludes to Bush getting killed resulted in Derek Wibley almost getting deported, question mark? According to an interview, he said that a reporter told House Minority Leader John Boehner about the song, and it turned out, in turn, Boehner apparently was trying to say that he was threatening the president and tried to get him deported, which I think Whibley is making this up. I cannot see John Boehner spending the hours and time trying to get this pop punk musician deported back to Canada. The band,
I don't know. Didn't they cancel Kathy Griffin for that photo, which I feel like is on par of, like, in terms of controversialness? Like, I don't know. Could happen.
Could happen. The band would support the album by playing some Warped Tour dates in the summer of 2007, eventually headlining the Strength in Numbers Tour, a tour of Canada with Finger 11.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. That's a name I haven't heard in a long time.
You and me both, my friend. During
talk about like pop punk kings of being on random compilation albums, too, by the way, to like tie it back to the compilation album you got with Sum 41 on it.
100%. 2009 saw the release of the band's first greatest hits compilation titled All the Good Shit, 14 Solid Gold Hits. And the album in Japan is known as 8 Years of Blood, Sake, and Tears, the best of Sum 41.
That's incredible.
I love it. So 2010 onwards, really, that was, you know, kind of the end of the band's heyday. They would begin recording their follow-up to Underclass Hero in 2008. 2009 announced that Gil Norton was the producer for their upcoming album. I should note, Gil Norton, other prolific producer, Echo and the Bunnymen's Ocean the Rain, The Pixies' Doolittle, Bossa Nova, and Trompe Le Monde, Foo Fighters' Color in the Shape, Dashboard Confessionals, A Mark, A Mission, A Brand, A Scar, and Jimmy Eat World's Futures. Just great, great rap sheet. That album, Screaming Bloody Murder, was released February 7th, 2011, after several delays, and it was the band's last album to be released on Island Records before they had fulfilled their contract, and their first album to not be released on Aquarius Records. The album would debut at number 31 and sold about 52,000 copies, so this was like a big departure, but it did result in their first Grammy Award nomination for Best Hard Rock Metal Performance, ultimately losing to Foo Fighters. And since then, in the last decade, they have gone on to release two more albums, 13 Voices in 2016, Order and Decline in 2019. And there have been some additional lineup changes in the last decade as well. Steve Yocks left the group in 2013 and in true LA fashion moved into a career as a real estate agent. He still performs. He still performs occasionally and also does stand-up, as I found out when I found his set he did at Ha Ha Comedy Club in LA in 2016, where he talked about having done blow with Tommy Lee, Metallica, and then also alluded to having done blow at this club before getting up on stage. So that was cute.
I wish you could see how big my eyes are right now. Like, not only are you cursing us with your comedy, but also it's cocaine-based comedy.
It was surprisingly funnier than I thought. I was expecting some like low rent Dane Cook, and there were some moments, but it was a lot funnier than I thought. I was pleasantly surprised. Meanwhile, Dave Vaksh did rejoin the group in 2015 after an almost decade long hiatus, and Cohn and Derek Whibley continued to be in the band to this day. Whibley has been the only continuous member since the band's inception in 1996, and he actually recently, in March, posted on his Instagram a photo of the 2001 MTV 20th anniversary performance, describing how much that performance changed their life and made them known to the world. They have gone on to sell 15 million records. And that's all I have for Sum 41.
Well, I think we have come to the end of our pop punk dissertation. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what you heard today or any of our other previous episodes, please make sure you rate and subscribe to us wherever you listen to this podcast. And you can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook at The Old Millennials Pod. And if you're really dying for our hot takes, you can follow us both individually on Twitter. I am at Marg She Wrote.
And I am at Emily A. Bajan.
And until next time, we say bye-bye.
Bye.